With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm True Crime Nana from Rochester, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, can and should all films and television shows be cast colorblind? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast for myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
We pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
Well, everything from our question from True Crime Nana from Rochester. Her question was, should all TV and film be cast colorblind? Dane, where do we start with that?
I don't think so. I'm always cynical about the whole idea of colour blindness. I think we don't need to arrive at a space socially where you don't see colour. It's embracing everybody irrespective of their colour, because, you know, no one ever makes a distinction between Care Bears. So I feel like, I get what she's saying, but, you know, certain casting, sometimes an aesthetic is pertinent to a particular story. I think that should be reflected in film and TV as well.
But needless to say, we ask all the questions.
We ask all the questions. We don't hold back. And if you have any questions for the podcast, then please get in touch with us. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify. And you can also find the podcast on Acast, the world's largest podcast network. And speaking of living large and in charge, today's guest is very esteemed, first of all, and it's been a real pleasure to finally get them on the show. And they are a writer, speaker, and social content creator, as well as benevolent influencer. I have to emphasize benevolent. Nothing but positivity from our guest. Her content has been featured in publications such as The Independent, Cosmopolitan, Elle, Huffington Post, and many more. Her online writing has been shared by the likes of Oprah Magazine, Khloe Kardashian, Hailey Bieber, and Amanda Seales. What a legend. And in 2019, she was announced as the first ever ambassador for the charity Young Women's Trust. It is the tremendous Tony Tone, no extra Tony.
Hi. Hi, Dane. Hi, Howard.
Hi. How are you?
That was such a lovely intro. Thank you.
We like to celebrate. We like to give flowers while people are here. We like to exalt. And we definitely make a point of principle to make sure we give extra pedestal to the Queen's damn Tony. So,
thank you.
Yes. So how have you been? What's been happening on this very warm day, for those who don't know? Have you enjoyed the sun?
Yeah, I've been good. I've been out lounging. I visited a very, very nice private members club that had a pool, and I was lounging there all day pretty much.
Is it back open?
It's back open. You know exactly where I'm talking about.
That's what's up. Well, yeah, live it, love it. Get some vitamin D to the pineal gland. Stimulate that. That's it. What's up? Enjoy. How have you been faring so far as artistically during the lockdown?
It's been intense. It's been tough, and it's been a moment for me to really reflect and work on my own like personal creativity. So there's been bad, but there's been, I guess, good in some way, if you can say good. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, it's been stressful. Like, my grandma had COVID. She's recovered now, thank goodness, but that was really tough. And being very, very conscious of like the fact I couldn't see her, couldn't visit her, couldn't spend time with her in hospital. She's almost 90 years old. But on the flip side, it's definitely encouraged me to create lots of content, to do lots of writing. And that has been good, I guess.
That's good, man. It's all balanced as well, man. And we give massive thanks for grandma being a fighter and pulling through, as we knew that she would.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
That's it. We give thanks. God is good. Only all the time.
all the time.
It's probably time for a question, Dane, isn't it? As the format dictates.
Absolutely. Ms. Tony Tone, if that's okay to use that honorific, we value you and so happy you came on the podcast. And we know you are a busy and influential woman. So as our esteemed guest, we invite you to ask the first question, which we'd like to discuss for 15 minutes and some change. Then how to do the same. I will do the same at the end. Lather, rinse, repeat. Everybody go have a nice time. Sound like
a
plan?
Good to me.
Perfect. Well, as I say, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And we invite you to have the floor and ask the first question.
Okay, so I have a question for both you and Howard. Do you think marriage is less of a priority for young people of today?
Interesting. I mean, and what inspired this question from you, Tony?
A lot of my content on Twitter focuses on relationships of all types, but relationships, marriage, friendships, family relationships. But one thing I have noticed from a lot of my tweeting is that it seems as if people have this impression that, oh, the generations before cared more about certain things. And you see a lot of tweets online from young people, oh, back in the day this, back in the day that. And I almost have this view that, oh, maybe there's a possibility that the way young people perceive marriage is very different from how, say, our grandparents perceived marriage. So I just thought I'd pose the question, see what you think, based on what I've seen on Twitter and the observations I've made on there.
No, it's a good point. I mean, I when it comes to like social media and stuff, I always tend to find take a lot of people's proclamations and how postulate on social media with a pinch of salt. So yeah. I really do find a lot of the time that people will go on there and say things that are incendiary or impulsive. And I always put it down to the fact that social media as a consciousness is relatively young. And so you do get quite an adolescent kind of narrative from a lot of people on social media. So I say that because obviously when people are young, the idea of marriage and settling down and having a lot more of a routine in matrimony, people find that a lot more daunting and, you know, I guess a reflection of a loss of youth. So I think that's why people may appear to kind of rebel against that when you see on social media. But that being said, I still think a lot of people, especially if they are still a part or have an affinity with their culture, particularly, you know, people maybe second or third generation immigrants, still consider things like marriage to have a certain level of significance when it comes to coupling or relationships or family in general. But yeah, at the same time as well, I also think that a lot of people are being very retrospective in terms of looking at the state of marriages between, like, you know, their predecessors and their parents and relatives and stuff. And I think, yeah, something you do a very good job of alluding to and addressing in a lot of your work, where it's like, just because people were married or there were certain things that your grandmother may have put up with because she was someone's wife, doesn't mean it's necessarily acceptable. And I think if there has been a decline in positive attitudes towards marriage, I don't think people are adverse to the idea of having a long-term partner and building a life with somebody. I don't think people are adverse to that. But I think if you take into account certain, I guess certain elements of liberalism, whether it's like third wave feminism or, you know, the legislation regarding civil partnerships and, you know, same-sex marriages, I think people maybe just take more of a relaxed approach to it. So it's not that I don't think people don't like the idea of marriage, but I don't think people think marriage is the same indicator of a long-term relationship or a union that it used to be. But then I'm not married, so I don't know. Whereas Howard,
this is what I was going to say. As a married man, could you imagine if I said that I didn't think it should be my wife? What would happen, Tara, if I said I didn't think marriage should be kind of, I guess, is it valued as much, or should it be valued as much? The reality of it to me in my relationship is simple. You know, I was not married to Tara for 3 years of our relationship, and I could not tell you that in terms of the dynamic of our relationship anything changed once we did get married, and that's obviously a sign that the relationship was a good one. And you know, I guess there's a kind of what does it mean to you? That's the point, is it? What does it really mean to you? And for me, it meant a party, you know, a celebration of our love. It wasn't anything that was supposed to do anything more than that. really. And
Howard, you're leaving out a particular nuanced aspect of your marriage that Tony needs to know. You have to give a context.
the bedroom element, which makes it sound more exciting.
The bedroom element. This sounds very interesting.
Makes it sound much more exciting.
You'll see. You'll see, ma'am. You'll see.
As listeners, long-term listeners will know of this podcast, I do not share a bedroom with my wife because I, basically, Tony, she would have killed me by now if we shared a bed. I not only snore like a lot of people, which can be compensated for, I move. I've got the arms. The arms go all over the place, you see, Tony. So on that basis, I can't really share a bed with her, which is obviously, I think, made a massive impact in our relationship. I think we have a happier relationship because, for example, if I want to watch football highlights from Italy.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good. You're missing it, Howard. If I want to watch football highlights in the remember myself. All right, Howard.
Is that what we call it now?
Married man now, Tony. He's a married man now, Tony. You have to use different words nowadays. Yeah.
I want to enjoy myself physically, independently of Tara, you know, or any other thing, including working late, which you could also call it a euphemism. then I can do it without disturbing her, physically or mentally. You know, that's got a lot of value to it that I think maybe makes the relationship work, I guess.
Yeah, I quite like that you're doing what works for you. I feel like sometimes when it comes to our concept of marriage, it could be very cookie cutter. Like, we do what is expected based on history, based on what we've seen in mainstream media. And for example, in your situation, the expectation is, of course, you would sleep in the bed with your wife. Why wouldn't you? That is strange. But you are doing what works for you. And obviously by doing that, then that is facilitating a more harmonious, I imagine, marriage for you because of all the things that you've obviously stated. And I think it's important for people to see situations like that. So they, because I actually met a couple, actually. I think I went to Goodwood. It was like the car thing that they do. And I was there with a friend and I met a couple and we were asking, them lots of questions. We found out that they had been together for years and years and years. And I said, oh, what's the secret? And the answer they gave was so funny. They said, the secret is living in two different countries. I was like, excuse me? And basically, they live in two. I think she lived in the UK, he lived in Italy. But they had been married for over 30 years. But they had their bases and they would meet up when it suited them. And that worked for them. And I thought that's really interesting because we do often think marriage has to fit a certain framework, and that's just not the case. But what's interesting about everything you said, actually, like I saw something, I think it was on Harper's Bazaar earlier this year, and it said the average age for first time marriage, I think, for women in the UK right now is 35. And I was actually quite shocked to read that. I thought it would be significantly younger. And then I did some digging and I saw that, like, if we look in our like parents and grandparents' lifetime, we go back, I don't know, 40 or so years in the 1960s, it was about a decade earlier. So you're looking at 25. Why do you think that might be?
I think people weren't living as long initially. I also feel like, I mean, for our predecessors and stuff like that as well, the idea of the coupling where you maybe be cohabiting a place and stuff like that, it was very different because, like, well, my parents have been married for like 41 years and I think they bought their house for like 80,000 and it's probably worth 5 or 6 times that now.
Yeah.
And I think, so I think inflation in terms of like the idea now where marriage is can be quite a significant investment as a civil partnership, where it's like cohabiting and putting together your assets. And I think that, it's a lot harder to accumulate the wealth required for most things that you get after marriage, like a home and like maybe a mortgage. So I think maybe people wait a little bit longer. And I think also, as I said, with the emergence of, you know, third wave feminism, you know, women are less inclined to acquiesce to these pressures of like having kids and settling down and getting married and pursuing some of their own interests, whether it's professional ones or whatever kind of aspirations they may have, or whether it's traveling or having new jobs and stuff. So I think that may be one of the reasons why people are a lot older. And I guess people are just maybe a lot more mature, and there are probably a lot more opportunities and a lot more of an infrastructure that will support people later on in life if they want to still entertain certain things. Like, there's a lot more, I guess, leisure and hospitality that is oriented towards people in their early 30s than they may have been 10 years or so ago. But I definitely agree with your point as well, that for me, I don't necessarily think that people are adverse to marriage. I think that now people are just more prepared, or more aware of their choices, more aware of other options available to them. And I think now that we just have more open discourse regarding the intricacies of relationships, then as it's like with Howard, it's like some people would be like, how you and your wife live is you're living in separate rooms, but it works for their particular relationship. And I've always found like with my parents, they're not particularly affectionate when I see them. They don't really hold hands, and that used to be like, why is that the case? But then I think they had a life before. I'm looking from the perspective of their son. They had a life before that, and I imagine all couplings or relationships, they continue to progress, and certain aspects of your relationship play less importance than others. But I really feel like the main part is that the two people that came together to form a partnership, which would include, you know, raising their children, giving their said children a better life than they had themselves, and just trying to build with the joint resources together, which I, for myself, that is what marriage kind of means to me. Like, obviously, you know, as Howard said, it's always nice that you can have that aspect of the pageantry and celebrate your love with your close ones, because you are trying to celebrate a union of two families or two groups of people. But for the most part, it's like, you know, in the same way that, like, my parents have never been in, they never really watch TV in the same room. And I think that definitely helps their marriage. So my mum always watches TV in her room, my dad's always in the living room. And so they never really sit down and watch the same shows together. And I think that is a very important part of marriage, is just to recognize that there is an individual that existed before your coupling, and they will have their own interests, their own rates of spiritual, emotional, and, you know, physical growth. And you kind of have to honor that. I think you always have to remember that, you know, should the worst happen, touch wood, like, that person still has to endure and still live a life where you may not be as capable to be supporting them all the time. So yeah, I think the
reality of it, to me anyway, is if you don't get married, and this is not to say to any listeners who aren't going to get married and stay in a long-term relationship that this is a problem for them, I just think for a lot of people, they want ultimate commitment. They may have had experiences where someone, you know, treated them badly, infidelities. Who knows? It could be a number of things. And I think to get the ultimate commitment from someone saying, basically, mate, until you're dead, I'm here. And I think that does, that, you know what I mean, Tony, right? That's what people, some people need. And not everyone needs that anymore, I guess, is why this question is so interesting.
Well, yeah. Although I don't necessarily mean think people don't need companionship. I just think that, I guess, society's priorities have kind of changed. And so I think as people have kind of moved in order to, I suppose, focus on those particular priorities, marriage maybe has taken a back seat, whereby it's no longer the singular indicator of adulthood anymore that it used to be.
Yeah, so 100%.
I think that's what's kind of changed it, is just the fact that, you know, it's people. And there are some, you know, quasi-patriarchal elements to the idea of being married, because a lot of the time there is a real unfairness where, like, if I'm in my late 30s and I'm unmarried, then I'm an eligible bachelor. Whereas if a woman is the same age as me, it's like, oh, she's left on the shelf. And I think, that with the emergence of a lot more liberalism, then people are, like, addressing that and being like, that is no way an indicator of yourself, of your eligibility for marriage is no longer an indicator of your self-worth as a woman anymore, and it shouldn't be.
I'm so glad you said that, because I'm on a YouTube show with some friends called Heels Off, and the amount of comments we get, particularly one gentleman that loves to tell us that, oh, you guys need to give it up, you're on the shelf, settle down and have kids, why do you have an online show? And it's what? Like, the majority of us are like late 20s, early 30s, and the abuse we get sometimes from men online about why we are unmarried and childless is insane to me. So I'm so glad, as a guy, you did say that, like, it is not indicative of anything.
I was raised by loads of women, and so, you know, my mother has six sisters, and for example, her second sister, my aunt, is based in America. Like, she used to live in East London, she moved to the States, you know, and she's forged a wonderful career for herself. She's raised her children. Like, to me, she's my spirit animal. And so to me, it's like, why would... And she's been in long-term relationships, but she, at the point, she's been like, well, this person is not supporting me the way I'm supporting them. He's not bringing anything additional to me as far as, like, industrially or fiscally. So it's like, she can get rid of them. And I'm like, hell yeah, why wouldn't you? You've raised your kids yourself. You made all your properties yourself. So what else is someone bringing to the table? And I think, like, as I said, it's always been for men who are insecure about the pursuit of a relationship, they've always had this kind of thing where it's like, oh, we can take advantage of the fact that women will become more desperate the later they get in life because they want to get married. And it's like, for me, it's nice that, you know, women are rebelling against that and are having a lot more of a discernible approach to picking a suitor, because a lot of time, a lot of women, and I'm sure if you speak to your predecessors, are like, well, like, my grandmother, for example, was divorced from my grandfather. for several instances of infidelity. And this is at a time when people were not getting divorced.
Yes.
Mm. And even when she did in the end, and she was, because he was abusive as well, and people would ask, oh, well, why did it take so long? Or why did you divorce? Why didn't you divorce him before? And she was like, well, you know, I had seven kids. So what was I supposed to do? But, you know, so I guess I've always been privileged in seeing very early on instances of women subverting these ideas about classical ideas about marriage and gender, classic gender roles. So, yeah, I don't think a woman's self-worth is not determined by how eligible she is to be married or how many kids she has, because there are many sinister ways in which people can realize that. And, like, people marry to get states to stay in countries, people marry to save assets, people marry to avoid going to prison. So, you know, that's no way to indicate. And to be honest with you, Tony, that guy just sounds like he really likes you ladies, and just doesn't know how to express it. He basically, you know what? When a man says that, he's just basically saying, why wouldn't you marry me?
Dane, you know what's so funny? I actually said that. We had our very last episode. It was an episode where you like read the bad comments. Yeah. And I said that. I was like, I feel like he really fancies one of us. And
he absolutely so does. Angry. He absolutely does. He loves you guys. Because who would go back again for the next topic? Who would go? Like, if you guys are unattractive and you're on the shelf, why is he going back to that same shelf? That's what amazing. I do. It's like there's an Aldi garage on Beckenham Road. I always go there and I'm like, oh, these cars are overpriced. But inside I'm like, one day when I can afford them, I'm gonna get myself an R8, Tony.
That is so hilarious. That is so funny.
But the thing to kind of conclude this question is to just say that no matter what, if you are in a relationship, you should be happy.
Absolutely. Like, and yourself, and nothing else.
Not happy as a person and therefore not the relationship isn't happy, then you need to communicate that with your partner and make it work. And that could be, you know what, it's like a really interesting, I always think about this, it's, you know how some people ask people to give stuff up once they end up in a relationship?
Yeah.
If you give up too much, I think you fucked it. I think your relationship won't last. And therefore, be happy, guys. That's the key.
Yeah, and we say guys because some of you may be in polyamorous relationships, and I don't want to offend you guys either. So,
guys is a term for anyone,
yeah,
isn't it?
Guys, yes. It exactly, and that means even if you're in a polyamorous relationship and not a monogamous one, long as you got all three or four of you guys are happy, have at it.
It was a really good question, though. Very I like good. That question a lot.
Very good.
Because we don't often get these kind of questions. We often just deal with really kind of hard-hitting, you know, we do a lot of race, don't we, Dane? And we do a lot of politics. So it's nice to talk about matters of the heart.
Absolutely.
So thank you, Tony, for that question.
I do say everyone loves love. So, you know, it's nice to talk about it.
Everyone loves love.
I tell you what else people love. It's the subject of my question, because everyone loves a bargain. Oh, everyone loves a bargain.
Oh, yeah.
So, Tony, as queen of budgeting, and then I will open this over to Dane. What things do you do to save money? Let's go. Let's dig in.
Okay.
Let's dig in.
So I guess off the back of the queen of budgeting, it's probably because I have my budgeting template that I share online. So I think that literally, like when I say it saved me, I can't even begin to stress how much it saved me. And I'm not just saying that because it's my template. I just mean managing my money in a way that encouraged me to actually look at the money I have and review it. And in my 20s, when I left uni, I was like living in overdraft. Like that is all I knew. And I had terrible habits. I would buy things I didn't need and I would buy things when I didn't feel great. And it was terrible. And it got to a point one day where I was like, okay, no, you need to fix up because you cannot live like this. You cannot go into adulthood living check to check in this way because you cannot control yourself. And I used to be so against checking my account. I did not want to know what the situation was.
If you do look, you kind of hide your eyes as you're doing it.
Like, the old financial dissonance. If I don't see it, I'm not broke. That's how. Exactly. I get it.
That was basically me. That was me. So, but then I got to a point where I was like, nah, you need to get it together. So I started, what I did was like I made a template, basically. It was just an Excel spreadsheet that forced me to put in my income every month, like input my expenditure every month. And then I did it so it carried over. So I could visualize how my spending was impacting my life. And it got to the point where I did not want to look at my accounts to becoming obsessive about looking at my accounts. And I got out of overdraft, I paid off all my debt. And in the space of 5 years, like my entire life changed. So when it comes to like me ensuring that I budget accurately and I don't spend money, it is about being one with my bank account and not sticking my fingers in my ears, not pretending, and being honest with myself and saying, look, what are you doing that needs to change? What are you doing that is not productive or beneficial when it comes to your financial situation? And another thing for me, I never used to check, in my 20s, I never checked my credit score. I did not do that. Then when I started reviewing my accounts, I signed up to different credit agencies. I even paid for one. So I get like a monthly report. I check my credit score, and I've become incredibly disciplined when it comes to that element of my life. So I think, because people have often talking, when we talk about not spending money, they often talk about like, oh, I take the bus instead of get on the car. I don't go to Zara every week. I cook at home and I don't go out to eat. But I think you can do a lot of the things you enjoy, but it's about discipline and about being honest when it comes to your spending habits. So that for me, yeah, was definitely key. So checking my accounts and being aware of the importance of credit.
That's fascinating. I mean, Dane, your relationship with money, I don't know. It's interesting. We've done nearly 70 episodes of this, and I've never asked you if you spunk all your money up the wall or not. But I don't think you do. I'm going to guess you don't.
No, I don't. I come from, culturally, I come from a money under the bed culture. I will say, though, is that, you know, my grandfather and that generation of people weren't particularly trusting of banks at a time where, you know, the Windrush generation and successive generations was 70% of all their business loans would be rejected, weren't really given a lot of mortgages. So had to learn a few more subversive ways of being able to save money. So when I was in university, just to avoid going into overdraft, Tony, I used to do a partner hand. Which, for those who don't know, is basically everyone, for example, will put in £20 in a partner hand. Let's say there may be 10 or 20 members of this partner. We'll put in £20 weekly. There's one person that holds that pot. And each week, one of us within that partner hand will get the entirety of that money.
That's such a good idea.
So that was a nice way we used to kind of save money, and was kind of a way of avoiding any kind of loans or any kind of APR.
That's clever.
So it was a real useful way of the people teaching us.
So you guys are incredibly diligent and intelligent about this in a way that I have to be honest and say I was never.
I had to be. I got a story why, though. I remember why. Because I could have been more than 13, and I went to a jumble sale and I bought a few comic books, and I asked a friend to borrow some money for it. And my dad found out that I borrowed money from somebody. And you have to understand, my dad is a pretty easygoing guy for like a Windrush generation or first generation immigrant. His three things are: do not lie and do not cheat, do not steal, and oh my God, do not borrow money from your white neighbors. Oh my God. I'm not going to go into detail, but put it this way. As I say to my friends, that might be the reason I've never had an overdraft or a mortgage, because the fear he put in me for borrowing money. Oh.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, actually, like second generation immigrants, where parents are so averse to credit. I actually wrote a thread about that the other day, about how like we're often raised to see debt and credit as the enemy, when it's not that black and white, because you can have good debt, good debt that contributes to your net worth, or good debt that acts as investment capital for future financial opportunities.
Loss leader, or and also liquidity as well. Obviously, being liquid is good, and having cash to pay stuff, but sometimes it's good to maintain your liquidity. And this is the reason why, like, even if you are working with debtors and creditors, you have that 28 days grace, because people understand that, you know, you have to be chasing invoices and the like as well. And since I've become self-employed, I did study business at university, but I do understand now the importance of having a credit card and building credit for the sake of a credit rating, and learning just the process of, because if it was up to me, like I would probably have the sensibility of like a drug dealer and be like, how much is that house? 500 grand? Here are a series of duffel bags. Or how much is the car? Here is one duffel bag. Because I was so afraid of debt, like so afraid of being in debt. And I just had that complex whereby it was always seen where you know, the more advanced systems of finance and wealth weren't really accessible to me as a black man. And so it was like, you need to save your money and not depend on anybody for a loan. I never had an overdraft. And, you know, I didn't get a credit card until a couple of years ago, when my manager was like, let's say a credit card, can you build credit? Because if you want to get a mortgage, then they need to see a line of credit and know that you're used to making regular repayments and stuff. So I just goes like, cool, I'll do it my way. I have a credit card, but it'll be directly linked to my current account with a direct debit. So it gets paid straight away. There's no long thing, because I just, I was so determined to save money. And also because I guess I always had these closeted creative urges. And I'd seen so many instances of aspiring creatives and their families suffering because they couldn't afford to pay the bills because the money wasn't coming so quick, which kind of made me put me off getting into comedy and the creative industry for a little while because, like I said, this Caribbean mentality where I'm just like, your job is to provide for your family. Your father won't be around all the time. If your sisters need help or your cousins need help or your mother needs help, not to be able to do so is out of the question. So I guess in terms of how I saved money was that was always my motivation, that it was I had all the old maxims, like if you want to buy something you should be able to pay for it twice, if you can't afford it you have to wait and go without. So I guess it's just always been a very very rigid way of disciplining myself and just being like,
do you relate to that, Tony?
I guess I guess my situation was quite different in that I had an early experience with debt, early experience with credit, and I was never necessarily like anti-credit and debt. And then I think what changed for me was as my parents garnered more knowledge about how to manage debt and how to manage credit, they eventually cascaded that to me. And by then it was a little too late because I was living an overdraft, but at least I guess it was in the right time because it was like, okay, you know what? This is the situation you're in. This is what you need to do. I have grown to learn about this. So this is how we can help you. And then, I guess my experience was different in that I never really had this mentality growing up that, oh, I needed to have, loads of money in my current account and never have debt. Like I had a credit card quite early. And that was partially me trying to build my credit because the overdraft was connected to my current account. So I didn't have a credit card when that happened. But then when I was in this debt situation, I was like, okay, now I've got my debt under control. I've paid my debts off. I'm in a fantastic situation. How do I now build my credit? And I was getting those credit cards and I was, and then I got a mortgage with my mother and I did lots of different things to help me have access to large amounts of credit should I need it. And now I'm in a position where, oh, if I needed to buy a car and pay for the entire thing at once, I could do it because I have access to that level of credit. And I think for me, it was like, I was of the view that, oh, it's very, very important to be able to build a financial reputation where if you need a massive cash injection and you don't have family or friends that can give that to you, you can go to a bank and you can get that. And I guess with me, I don't know, there are some views that I don't necessarily have in the traditional sense. So you mentioned like, oh, how some people say, for example, if you can't buy it twice, don't buy it. I think now with my budgeting spreadsheet, I've realized even if you can buy it twice, three times, sometimes still don't buy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been in situations where I've like walked into certain stores and I'm like, I really love this bag. And I'm like, I could buy this bag. I could buy five of these bags, but do I need this bag? I really don't. So for me, it's also about like...
yeah, that's me all the time. It's me. That's me in Selfridges all the time. Just walking around and then being on a second floor and being like, so are you that much of a consumer? Who are you really? Fine, but... Oh, hello.
Yeah, right. You're capitalist. Is it by force you need this? What are you trying to prove? Yeah, I'm in a constant battle with myself when it comes to spending money. But I think what has also helped is with age and obviously getting older and considering different responsibilities, similarly to you, Dane, where like I'm the oldest of three children. Oh. And I am very aware of the fact that should, God forbid, anything happen to my parents, my siblings, even though they are adults, they are still going to look to me for guidance because there is this maternal role I play within the family unit. And for me, it's like, okay, you know what, Tony, you need to have your money on point because God forbid the worst happens. You need to be able to support your siblings in a way that you would like them to be supported. And just thinking about contributions towards the family as well. And I think being West African, being Nigerian, especially if you are second generation and you are the oldest of your group of siblings, people sometimes forget that for the eldest siblings, it's not just a financial responsibility for them alone. They are financially responsible for a lot of people, or at least they contribute in ways that typically the first child of maybe a Western family wouldn't contribute. So there's sometimes a lot of pressure there because culturally there are certain expectations. I know for one as well, like in Black households, there is no palming your mother off into a old people's home or your father off into an old people's home. You are taking care of them.
Absolutely. Out of the question.
So for me, it's like, I need to make sure that my money is good because my parents are getting older. And as I've gotten older, that is always in the back of my mind. Like I need to have the money there so I can take care of them when they can no longer work.
Absolutely.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, obviously being from a different ethnic group, and an ethnic group that is famous for being good with its money, which is obviously complete bollocks, because I can show you. You think Jews run the world? They can't even run their own bank accounts, people. Don't worry about that.
Like regular people.
Yeah, and I can tell you that my relationship with money definitely was influenced by my father, good rest his soul, who definitely went through some ups and downs in his life, which mean you look at it so differently. And I would tell you this, I have very few money saving tips, because basically I don't really spend my money on anything other than the place I live, the food I eat, and the holidays I go on, and everything else is a vital expense. My wife has to remind me to buy clothes
because
they get too old. And you know what? I think my favourite money-saving thing, before we move on to Dane's question, reduce sections at supermarkets. That's when you've... I was so good at that reduce section that I even, like, you know, back in the day, had a real, real skill for the timings. Just getting the timings right. I don't know if you guys ever did that, but...
You know what? I could actually... Low-key, I can relate to that. My local Sainsbury's, like, there are certain times of the day where the reduce section is popping, so I know exactly.
M&S Food Hall is right next door to the Sainsbury's in the retail park. So when they have their reduce, oh man, if you see the fruit platters in this house, I don't even like pomegranate and kiwis, but if it's reduced, then you are added to the platter. So I get it. I totally get it.
Well, thank you for answering that question. It was very, very useful.
It's so useful. I just opened up a pages. I'm gonna do an Excel spreadsheet after this from now on for my incoming and outgoings.
Oh, it's so addictive.
Nice.
Like, I look at mine like every single day. It gets to a point when you're in a good financial position, it's the opposite. You know, when you're in a bad one, you don't want to look at your bank account. When you're in a good one, it's like, let me just remind myself how good I am and how disciplined I am.
Looking forward for that bread. Let's land that bread a good home. Here you go. Here you go, money.
Right?
Have a seat right here with your brothers and sisters now. Incidentally, also called a mo money.
I just think, you know what, I was looking at your spreadsheet template thing, and I thought, you know, our viewers could listeners could really do with some advice. So there we go, over to Dane for the final question of today's episode.
Yes sir and madam. So Tony, as I'm sure you know, I've discovered your work on the show The Grapevine.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And found you to be very intelligent and very insightful. And it's a really great show. Now, I guess that led me down a very nice rabbit hole of a number of, special interest shows on YouTube, podcasts and the like, discussing just, you know, everyday issues for the diaspora. What I found comes up a lot, though, is for some of the, some of the shows which may not be of the same level of verbosity and also depth as The Grapevine, a theme frequently comes up. There's a very narrow spectrum of topics that I think a lot of black podcasts and shows discuss, and it's normally revolving around relationships, dating, cheating, and expectations of dating. And I really feel like, you know, obviously it goes without saying, but I'd like to say it again, black lives matter, but black love also matters. And I feel like in our amongst our plight and our struggle for equality and equity, sometimes we forget that, you know, even as strong and as battle-hardened as we are, we need a tender touch as well. But then at the same time, and I know it's taken a long time, but I'll get to it. But at the same time as well, I feel like there is a reason why these comments frequently come up in discourse amongst my black peers and stuff. And I think, like I said, I think, you know, as we said before, love is, God is love. And yeah, love is the most important thing. And everyone wants to be loved. And however, I have found, even with my own personal experiences, that when you are pursuing other aspirations that are not of, or other pursuits which aren't necessarily romantic, you tend to find less people that look like you around and share mutuality with them. So my question was to you, how difficult do you think it is to find love between two black people in the UK?
I think when it comes to black people finding love in the UK, I don't think it's any different from other races finding love in their home country, because the UK is a very diverse place, particularly in London. And a lot of these shows that we watch and we see online, they are London-based. They have a London cast, London crews, people from London discussing their love lives and dating experiences. So I don't think it's necessarily that it's any more difficult than elsewhere, but there are different challenges. Like you said, challenges being, what happens when you're out of London? Are you going to see as many black faces? If I'm in Yorkshire and I'm a black person and I'm looking to date another person of my race and my culture, how easy is it? Is it going to be?
It's not easy. Like, for example, I in Huddersfield, which was near the university, I couldn't date half the black women in Huddersfield because half the black women in Huddersfield are my cousins. So, and that is true. Half the black women in Huddersfield in West Yorkshire are distant, if not close, relatives. And I even met a few women who showed interest, and my first cousins had to tell them, you can't date him. And they'd be like, why not? Because he's your cousin. So
so I think when it comes to when we're talking about difficulties, when we're talking about difficulties in the connection and chemistry sense, I don't think it's necessarily any more difficult than any other race. But when it comes to geography and accessibility, I do agree that it is more difficult than the average white person who lives in the UK, because everywhere you see people that look like you. If you go to Hull, if you go to Yorkshire, if you go to Leeds, if you go to Brighton, you're not seeing as many black people as you're seeing in and around London. But I think with that said, one thing I do promote is black people not being afraid to date outside of their geographic area. And the reason why I say this, I have a lot of friends that talk about, I don't live in London, I actually live outside of London. I'm an Oxford girl. I've lived in Oxford pretty much all my life. And I've dated one person in my city, and outside of my four relationships that I've had, and I'm in one now, they've not been from Oxford, apart from that one person. And I think sometimes people are of the opinion that, oh, I must date in my geographic bubble because it will be easier. But sometimes the best things aren't always the easiest things. Like, sometimes you have to step outside of your geographic location. Sometimes you have to think outside of the box. A lot of black people, I mean, the view is changing now. People are more open to online dating, but I think culturally, the black community is slightly more averse than the white community when it comes to the concept of online dating and the benefits of it. But I do think if you are black and you do not live in a location that is very black, then you do have to think outside of the box. You have to be more creative with the places you go, creative with how you use online media, and be open to stepping outside of your comfort zone. And that might mean traveling elsewhere to meet more black people. Because, for example, I have family and friends who live very down south. So family and friends that live in Brighton, for example, and they've had to travel elsewhere, and they've managed to find love elsewhere, but with the knowledge that, okay, I want to find a relationship, and in Brighton I know every black person and I'm not interested in them, so I'm going to travel to London, I'm going to travel to Manchester. And for some, it's even like long distance relationship country to country, because they've managed to meet people online. So as far as the chemistry and connectivity element, I don't think it's any more like difficult than any other race, but as far as the geography and meeting people, yeah, you have to be creative as a black person if you're not a black person living in and around a metropolitan area like London.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, yeah, as I said, especially if you want to, if it is interracial dating you are kind of looking for, you are there definitely subject to very dwindling resources depending on what part of the country you're in. Because even if you haven't been with anybody or you don't know them, you may have friends, and by the 60 degrees of separation, it can be very difficult. Yeah. And I think, as you said, the internet has been crucially important for, I think, particularly black people who exist and thrive outside of the metropolitan cities in this country, in order to connect themselves and find that, you know, find cultural references, valid cultural references, as well as the opportunity for pursuing romance outside of their immediate area. And I think that's been massively important. I really hope that, like, black people continue to pursue opportunities for romance online, you know, because I remember growing up and people being on like Black Planet and my friends talking to people from like America and stuff and Black Chat. Yeah. Like, I wasn't really into it because I probably had a time where I was just like, why go Black Planet? You know that there's girls that live in Hounslow. Look how far that is, bruv. Don't sit in that, bruv. It's out of this world. Might as well go to Mars. So, yeah, I think it's a very important thing. I don't think Black people are adverse to dating one another within London and surrounding areas. But yeah, I can only definitely speak from personal experience. And you kind of have to take into account the social paradigms that people observe. Because before I started doing comedy, when I used to work in like offices, there'd be Black women there, but some of them may be older than me. So they may not be interested in dating Black men. But yeah, it was just very hard to observe any kind of social paradigm where you could kind of meet people. Because just before I started comedy, like 2010 in earnest, but like 2008, so like 2010, mm-hmm. Raving was done. So you couldn't even go out to like clubs and socialize in normal fashions to meet people because mm-hmm. a lot of the normal haunts where you'd go and socialize had kind of been shut down. And at that time, I really wish that the internet was around. So I think we only had like MySpace was the closest thing to a social network at the time. But I really wish that there had been like university now. If I knew as a kid now, I could go on Tinder or Bumble or Hinge to find somebody and not have to go to clubs in like West Yorkshire. Oh, I'd be so happy. I couldn't imagine like having to go back. And I think, yeah, just being able to, like I said, have that connection and be prepared to travel is, it's infinitely important. So I've even got a friend. My friend he's based in obviously the UK, but his girlfriend is based in Dubai. And I think going back to even the first question we had at the beginning of the episode, it's like, I think that's important for a good relationship. I think sometimes, even if you're a Black person, you're dating another Black person who may live in another country or another part of the country, I think it's kind of good because it means that absence makes the heart grow fonder, even though I know I'm a bit of a romantic in that respect, but it does. It adds a certain element of novelty to your encounters with your partner. I think you give the breadth between that to pursue your own interests. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, I'm in a relationship with somebody who is a long distance relationship now where they live up north, but like in between that, they have time to grow as personally and spiritually and, you know, pursue their interests. I have time to do the same. So then when you do finally meet up, then you just completely focus on one another.
Yeah. And,
well, you've got to try things in life, haven't you? I think that's one of the things that might be the lesson of today's episode is, you know, trying things, you know, you can't, I think there's some people, and I'm not sure what, you know, Tony, you feel this way or Dane, but some people rebel against being within their own group, right? As in, kind mm-hmm. of, you know, yeah. their first instincts were to not do that. I can tell you that was certainly my instinct. I was not enamored.
I didn't want to date girls in Lewisham either. Obviously, I'm from Lewisham Borough in South East London, and I didn't want to go out a lot of the girls from the area.
I didn't want to try and date a Jewish girl when I was young. You know, I was really not that I could date any girl, to be
I'm
honest with you, when I was young.
I swore I would never date a Nigerian man ever.
and I had no problem. I had no problem with it necessarily, but for me, it was just, especially at a time when I'm a virgin and toxic masculinity, it was not a concept that existed at the time. And it's like, I don't want a girl that I had sex with to anyone else to know I had sex with her. If I'm bad in bed, then I can't show my face in the borough anymore.
But oh, God.
If my girl's from, yeah, but if she's from Haringey, who's going to know?
But I did the thing Dane knows, Tony, and maybe listeners remember this from another episode, did 76 internet dates to find my wife. And it wasn't like I forced it. It had to be 76 or anything. It was she was number 77. And the thing I think you know happened. I don't know if I've ever told you this, Dane, but there was a point where a mutual friend of ours, Dana Faye, said you should probably try your own lot. Like, try some Jews because you know it hasn't worked out with the rest of the world so far. And so I had a kind of 6 month J-date Jew fest and. Not successful at all. And you know what? I'm really pleased that I did it now. Because you know what I mean? You should have, you know, if I'd have maybe never found Tara and never been happy, I might have always gone, well, maybe I should have, you know, I think the phrase stick to your own is obviously a really difficult phrase because it has a lot of racial, but for some people that might really work. Culturally, they need the people close to, you know, who have that same identity. Some people don't.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it depends on person to person. And, you know, I think that it can be very, so far as like attraction to somebody, even when you say stick with your own kind, that can be a very ambivalent statement as well, because you can be with somebody from the same place as you on paper, but it's whether they share the same kind of value system, I suppose, and the same ideas and beliefs and stuff. So I think it's like you said, Tony. It's like it's high risk, high reward. It's how much effort you are prepared to put. I personally feel like when people do kind of lament the idea they can't find somebody, it's like you're talking about a state of being, which is the one that most people on the planet look for. Like, if you're looking for love, shouldn't you be concerned if it was too easy to find?
Right, I would be worried.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So even with me, when people kind of like, you know, you think about settling down and blah blah, it's like it's not. I mean, I'm not that too focused on the language or the idea of settling down, but it's like, if we are talking about, you know, if anyone who's experienced love, and if you're talking about the potential highs and a potential improvement to your life, to be sharing your life with somebody else, that is going to involve a lot of work. If you're, like, yeah, you know, in the same way that if you are pursuing a creative dream of a professional nature, then you are aware of the sacrifices that are required to realize that dream. And if you're going to find somebody who's supposed to, you know, complete you, be your better half, then, you know, it might require, yeah, you being less insular within your own community, being prepared to travel, and yeah, walk 500 miles like the Proclaimer said.
Well, I mean, what a brilliant episode that's
absolutely
been today.
That,
so positive, so much. Not, we're not always this positive, Dane. Tony, that's definitely, we've got
we
a lot more
positive
anger.
Did you even see when Tony said she was in a relationship? I didn't even throw my microphone down and kick off my laptop or anything. I took it on the chin like a champion. You will be getting some very acerbic YouTube comments on the next episode of Heels Off Her. This girl won't marry anybody, you know.
Yeah, brilliant.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for gracing us.
Such a lovely time. Thank you for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for coming on. I'm aware that most people would love to hear more from you, so please tell our listeners what projects you're working on, where they can find some of your great works, and what you have in the immediate future.
Oh, there's some stuff I don't even want to say. It's juicy. I don't even want to say, because I still have to put pen to paper, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly. Not until the bag is in front of you is it secured.
Exactly. So I'm waiting for the bag to be directly in front of me. But as far as like what I'm working on, still want to produce loads of content, working on lots of writing at the moment. I have some special surprises in store. So if people want to find out what they are, they could just follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Tony Tone, but with zeros instead of O's. So T, just to be awkward, you know, T0NI, T0NE. But yeah, I have some stuff in store, but I'm just waiting to put pen to paper and then I shall announce.
Well, you are now part of the Dane Baptiste Questions Everything alumni, and therefore we will always share and promote whatever one.
Absolutely, just tag me and let me know. And also to listeners, subscribe to Heels Off as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, thank you so much.
My Tony pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show. We've all managed to do it in the time frame we hoped we would.
love it when a plan comes together. Thank you so much. Ooh, Tony,
thank you so much for having me. Have you got much plan for the rest of the day?
I've got another show to do, so I'm about to go jump on and do a Zoom show. So
I'm gonna
get vomited on by a baby.
Oh.
So
lucky.
Two very different situations, but very, very good nonetheless.
Exactly. All labors
yourself,
of love.
Tony, look after yourself and enjoy the sun for the while it's still here, eh?
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Tony.
Bye. You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Tony Tone. You can follow Tony on Twitter and Instagram at Tony Tone. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at the Howard Cohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Decode. You can follow D on Twitter and Instagram at Official Decode. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.